From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, exploring the world beneath our feet, journalist Will Hunt is fascinated with things underground, exploring sewers and subway tunnels, even underground streams in New York, usually in the wee hours.
Every manhole, every doorway, every stairway going down into the dark felt like a potential portal into this separate world.
Hunt's new book is called Underground. Also, we listen back to my interview with pianist and composer Michel Legrand, who died on Saturday at the age of 86. He wrote the score for the film Umbrellas of Cherbourg. And Maureen Corrigan reviews a new novel about a girl who feels most like herself when playing basketball. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ever been waiting for a subway and feel the impulse to hop off the platform and wander down the tracks, or pop a manhole cover on a city street and go exploring the sewers? That's the kind of exploring our guest Will Hunt likes to do, looking below the surface of streets and of the earth. He spent years prowling the inner recesses of subways and sewers, the catacombs of Paris, abandoned mines and nuclear bunkers, and caves where ancient societies held religious rituals. His new book shares some of what he's found, like people living in subway tunnels and underground art in Paris. And he explores why some people just seem compelled to burrow into the ground. Will Hunt's writing and photography have been published in The Economist, The Paris Review, and Outside Magazine. He spoke to Fresh Air's Dave Davies about his new book, Underground, A Human History of the Worlds Beneath Our Feet.
Well, Will Hunt, welcome to Fresh Air. You describe in this book getting interested in things under the ground and being on a subway platform, and you see these two guys emerge from the tracks, like with headlamps on, and they just walk up the stairs. Who were they? What was going on?
So these were urban explorers. This is a tribe of people in New York City who have dedicated their lives to exploring and documenting the lost and forgotten parts of the city. And I just became totally fascinated with them. They were these sort of urban outlaw poets. And I love that they sort of saw a version of New York City that was invisible to everyone else. They knew the city's secrets. They knew the subterranean rivers and the abandoned subway stations and all of these places that people on the surface never think about. So I just became fixated on them and started poking around with them in tunnels and sewers and in other places out of sight.
Right. So you became one of these explorers. How easy is it to hop into the subway and disappear?
Practically, it's not so difficult. It's just a matter of going down late at night and waiting for a train to pass and deciding to step over the do not cross or enter track sign and just heading down the catwalk. I would say psychologically, it's much more difficult. It's very frightening down there, and there's a lot of pressure, and you're thinking a million things at once, and you're listening for trains, and you're listening for track workers down there. And it's illegal, of course, so if you get caught, then the consequences are dire.
And rats?
There are rats, indeed. You know, there are a lot of hazards down there. I mean, when you get into tunnels that have a sort of a tight corner, that can be very scary because you can't see the trains coming around the corner so easily. There are these passengerless garbage trains that come through, and they don't really run on a schedule, so they can come up behind you at any time. I was fortunate enough never to have witnessed one of those, but that's always in the back of your mind. It can be pretty treacherous down there.
So what would you do when you were in the subway and a train came?
This was always unnerving, to be down on subway tracks and to have a train come up behind you, right? It registers first as this kind of like sort of subsonic rumble at your feet, and then you hear, or rather you feel, wind, and suddenly there's this blast of light coming behind you. And what you have to do is jump up on the catwalk and run down the catwalk and find an emergency alcove where you can hide yourself while the train rushes past. And the truth is, you sort of plan for trains passing. What I would do is I would enter the subway tracks and run down the catwalk and kind of hover around the emergency exit alcove and wait for a train to come. And the train would come and I would still be hidden. And then once the train was gone, I would be able to safely continue down the tracks.
And what did it feel like when the train went by?
Most people don't really have the experience of being near a train when it's moving at full speed. You know, a train slows down at a platform usually. So when you're in the tracks and you're kind of crouched in an emergency exit alcove, the train is hurtling through the dark. So you're getting this really intense sound and wind and this kind of rush of metal. And it's, you know, your heart is pounding. It's very intense.
What kind of gear do you need to do this to stay safe?
I would just go down with wearing dark clothes and a headlamp or a flashlight, and just shoes with good traction. That's all you really need. I should say that I don't condone doing this. It's very dangerous and a good way to get arrested. And I don't want people listening to this and thinking they should go and run down the tracks at night.
You described some fascinating stuff you discover. There were dangers and difficulties, but what did you discover that fascinated you?
Well, there's just so much beneath the streets of New York City that people walking around on the surface don't ever think about. I mean, one of the things that I fell in love with right off the bat was this graffiti writer called Revs, who during the 1990s spent 6 years writing his autobiography on the walls of subway tunnels, which is to say between platforms in the sort of dark spaces that are hard to reach and covered in soot. It's like the no man's land. And he would go down and put up a 5 by 7 foot rectangle of white or yellow paint and then write a little vignette from his childhood on the panel. And he would number them within a series and then sign it. And there are 235 of these panels scattered throughout New York City. And when I was first starting to go down to the tunnels, I would come across these pages, and I just thought it was such a beautiful and mysterious art project.
And you discovered there are people there. You refer to the mole people. Who are they?
So the mole people are people who have taken up residence in the underground of New York City. During the 1980s, they were sort of everywhere in the underground of the city, and today there are many fewer of them. There's a tunnel that runs under Riverside Park that is where they used to live, and they had built an amazing shanty town down in the tunnel. It's called the Freedom Tunnel, and during the 80s, there were over 100 of them. Today, there are not so many, but there was one night where I went down to that tunnel with a group of urban explorers, and we celebrated the 50th birthday party of a woman named Brooklyn, who had been living in that tunnel for 28 years, she said. We went down with whiskey and cake, and we sort of sat around on the stairs outside of her home down there. And
can you just describe the home? Where was she living?
It was in the eaves of the tunnel, kind of in this alcove that was accessible by an iron staircase. She called it her igloo. And, you know, there was a mattress and some sort of bent pieces of furniture. She was a really amazing woman, very charismatic and dynamic. That night, she spent hours singing and dancing, and it was a really great party.
So you went through the subways, and you went through sewers too, right? A fair amount?
I did. So I sort of started following around an urban explorer called Steve Duncan, who is kind of the master urban explorer in the city. And when he took me down into a sewer in Brooklyn, kind of near the Brooklyn Navy Yard, and we climbed down, and it was sort of an extraordinary experience. At first, the sewer felt kind of repulsive in the way you would imagine. You know, it's got this funk to it. There are these long, stringy strands of bacteria down there that urban explorers called snotsicles. So I'm kind of repulsed at first, but Steve tells me that there's a stream flowing through the wastewater in this tunnel, and so we're walking up and down this sewer pipe, and there's something really beautiful about knowing New York City as this big growling metropolis, this like big tough place, and then to be under the streets feeling this ancient stream flowing around your boots. The city felt very vulnerable. It was like I was making eye contact with the city. It was a kind of beautiful moment.
So there are sewers, there are subways, there are underground streams in cities. A lot of people don't realize this. As you became more familiar with this, did it just change your perception of the city you lived in? Did you talk about it with friends? Did you say, hey, you don't know what's like a block away here? Did you find yourself wanting to lift every manhole and go down it?
I absolutely did. There was a time when I would just move through the city in a kind of delirium. I was, you know, every manhole, every doorway, every stairway going down into the dark felt like a potential portal into this like separate world. My friends at the time would get so tired of me telling stories about all these spaces. I remember finding a building in Brooklyn Heights that looked exactly like every other building on the street, except the windows were blacked out and the door was made of dark steel. And as it turns out, the building was a subway vent, and it had been disguised. And it was just this beautiful thing of recognizing that hidden in the sort of texture of the city all around you are these portals into this like hidden layer. And, you know, the city, it started to feel really magical to me.
Our guest is Will Hunt. He has written a new book about life underneath the earth. It's called Underground, A Human History of the World Beneath Our Feet. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and we're speaking with Will Hunt. He is a writer who has a fascination with things beneath the surface of the earth. His new book is Underground, A Human History of the Worlds Beneath Our Feet. You have a fascinating chapter about the underground in Paris, and you describe an expedition that you and, three or four friends took, a 2 to 3 day trip where you were going to traverse the city of Paris, south to north, if I recall, underground, right?
That's correct. This was a few years ago. I was with a team of 6 urban explorers, and the plan was to go from one edge of the city to the other using only subterranean infrastructure. And we started on the southern edge of the city, and our path was going to be through the catacombs and then through utility tunnels to go under the Seine and then ultimately into the sewers. So we went down on a June night, starting in the catacombs. We were aware of a number of hazards. It was all illegal, of course, so we had to avoid the police. We were also aware of sort of bad air that sometimes collects in unventilated underground tunnels. So we had these toxic air detectors. But most of all, we were concerned about the weather. This was June in Paris, which means rain, and we were nervous about going into the sewers and getting caught in a rainstorm. The way the sewer system works in Paris, if you're in a sewer collector during a rainstorm, you could get caught in a flash flood. So we start in the catacombs, kind of winding through this maze of very beautiful stony tunnels. We emerge from the catacombs and head into the utility tunnels and slip under the Seine. And as we're making the transition from the utility tunnels to the sewers, we have cell phone service for a second, and we get a message from a friend of ours who had agreed to be the sort of weather sentinel. And he says, it looks to be a wet night. So now we're standing in a sewer collector, and we have a decision to make. Are we going to push through this collector and risk getting caught in a rainstorm, or are we going to give up the expedition and turn back? And at this point, we've been underground for 30 hours. So we all went around the circle and said, you know, we have to do this. There's no turning back. So over the next hour or so, we were kind of tiptoeing down the sewer collector, and it's this big echoing pipe with a channel of sewage running down the center. And it was extremely intense. Occasionally there would be these jets of water coming out of the walls, and everything is magnified down there. So a jet of water would come out of a pipe in the walls, and we would all freeze thinking that this is it. There's a rainstorm coming. In the end, we did make it out. We climbed up through a manhole just outside the northern boundary of the city, emerging at the foot of a restaurant in the street. And, you know, we surprised all these people who were sitting and eating lunch. A waiter spilled a tray of silverware on the street as six people climbed out of the underground, you know, spattered in all forms of ejecta. And then we skulked across the street and had opened a bottle of champagne to celebrate.
Tell us a little bit about the Paris Underground. I mean, there's a storied history of the catacombs. Just describe a bit for us.
So a lot of people are familiar with the tourist track in the catacombs, where you can walk down a tunnel lined with skulls and bones. So that runs about a mile. And beyond that, there are 200 miles of catacombs beneath the city. It's just this wild, earthy honeycomb of stone tunnels that were originally dug as quarries. So all of the elegant buildings along the Seine are made from blocks of limestone that were dug out from beneath the city. So the earliest tunnels there were dug, I believe, by the Romans, who were in the city when it was known as Lutèce. And, you know, every subsequent people to populate the city of Paris has you know, dug out this system wider and deeper. And today, it's just this completely magical labyrinth down there.
You have a chapter called The Burrowers. And you begin with the story of a guy named William Little, an Englishman. Tell us about him.
So in the 1960s, this man named William Little, who lived in the London neighborhood of Hackney, decides that he wants to dig a wine cellar under his house. So he goes down into his basement with a shovel and starts digging. And he works for several hours and is able to hollow out a chamber large enough to keep wine. But then something strange happens. He can't stop. Something inside of him snaps and he can't stop digging. And he keeps digging and digs for 40 years. He spends, you know, all this time excavating a kind of hidden network of tunnels beneath his house. I think it would go down maybe 60 feet and 40 feet in either side. It was to the point where his neighbors at night could hear him kind of scratching away in the tunnels beneath their gardens. And then in 2006, the street in front of his house collapsed. One of the tunnels had given way. And this sort of secret labyrinth that he had created was revealed to the public. And the city council came in and inspected and realized that the house was not livable. You know, as William Little had become obsessed with digging tunnels, he had stopped keeping up his house. So everything was overgrown and falling apart. And the city council come in and they say, okay, you can't live in this house anymore. And they remove him to like a city-owned high rise. And they put him in an apartment in the highest story so as to preclude the urge to burrow. And he, you know, meanwhile, he's become a kind of folk hero in the neighborhood of Hackney. Everyone knows about William Little. Everyone, you know, he's in the tabloids as the Mole Man of Hackney, and he's doing interviews. And what fascinated me about William Little is that he never could give an explanation for what compelled him to burrow. He would give these interviews to tabloid journalists, and they would say, like, what, you know, why are you doing this? And he would sort of shrug and say, I guess I'm just a man who likes to dig.
Will Hunt, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Dave.
Will Hunt is the author of Underground. He spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies, who is also WHYY's senior reporter. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel, The Falconer, and we'll listen back to my 1996 interview with Oscar and Grammy-winning French composer Michel Legrand. He died Saturday at the age of 86. Here's Legrand at the piano, playing music from The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, the part which was adapted into a hit song with English lyrics titled Watch What Happens. He wrote all the music for the film. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Moo, offering premium print products and 24-hour support, working to help businesses stand out with thick papers and a range of finishes. Learn more at moo.com. Moo. Dream it. Print it. And from Linguistica 360, with news in slow Spanish, news in slow French, Italian, and German programs. Weekly language learning shows with discussion of current events. More at newsinslow.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to remember Michel Legrand, a French pianist and prolific composer of film scores and songs. He died Saturday at age 86. Over his career, which spanned six decades, Legrand won three Oscars for his music in Yentl, Summer of 42, and The Thomas Crown Affair. He also won five Grammys. I spoke with Legrand in 1996, after the release of a restored version of the film The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, which is one of my favorite films. It's sung through, which is to say all the dialogue is sung. Legrand composed all the music. The film was written and directed by the late Jacques Demy and first released in 1964. It made a star of the young actress Catherine Deneuve. The film tells the story of two young lovers who are broken apart when the young man, Guy, is drafted and sent to Algeria for 2 years. In this scene, the broken-hearted Genevieve, played by Deneuve, begs him not to leave her. He promises to love her for the rest of his life. This part of the score was adapted into a song with English lyrics called I Will Wait for You that became a hit in America.
Mais je ne
Michel Legrand, how did Jacques Demy first describe to you his idea of a movie in which all the dialogue would be sung? I'd like to know your reaction when Jacques Demy said, well, let's do it like an opera where everything is sung. Did you think, hey, what a great idea, or did you think he was a little crazy?
No, because Jacques wasn't a crazy man. No, I said, you know, I think it's a good idea, we should try. And then we tried, and I couldn't find, because, you know, when I started to work on it, it was very complicated, you know, classical, very modern classical music. And I said, and Jacques and I, we said to ourselves, you know, it should be, if we do something like that, it should be, music should be readable and understandable. The first time, Jacques said to me, it should be like a song, one song from beginning to end, like one aria, one thing, because he said people have to understand it the first time they hear it. You know, so I changed my mind, I changed my pencil, and I tried, and finally we came up with what, you know.
Yeah, and it's jazz and ballads. And
yeah, but mostly it's melodic, you know, from
very
beginning
melodic
to end. Yeah,
well, beautiful chords also.
Yeah, because, you know, they exist, so we have to use them.
What's that?
The chords, I mean, you know, we have to use the chords which are existing, so we use almost all of them.
Now, in a lot of ways, the Umbrellas of Cherbourg to me is like if you made An Ordinary Life into an MGM musical, and you took the sets of an MGM musical and combined that with the gas station on the corner, what would you get? Because it takes the scenes of Ordinary Life and kind of elevates it to the beauty of an MGM musical. Was that what you both had in mind?
No, we wanted to do a very ordinary story. You know, the ordinary triangle, because, you know, this beautiful young girl, she does not wait for her lover to come back, and she marries someone else. At the same time, we wanted to use very ordinary, everyday language, simple, very simple. So the music had to be very melodic, but exactly like one song from beginning to end, you know. And then the color will be very exaggerated. So it's a huge dream in a very ordinary life.
Now, was the dialogue written first? Did Demy give you the dialogue and say, okay, now you can compose a score around it?
Yeah, because Jacques, you know, originally had written the dialogues on every scene. Since Demy wanted to shoot it as a normal movie, without music, without, you know, singing. And so we took scene by scene, and you know, I come up with a tempo, with a melody, and then we changed in every scene. We changed all the dialogue, because I said, Jacques, no, here one ta da 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 da. So he adapted everything, and then he put one syllable under every note that I was proposing to him.
Now, I'm wondering if it was difficult for you to set the scenes that aren't the more romantic or disillusioned scenes, but just the more everyday scenes. Like, in the very beginning, there's a scene where Guy, you know, the romantic lead, is working at the gas station, and he's just fixed a customer's car. And Guy says, "Finished," and the customer says, "It rattles a bit when the motor's cold, but that's normal." That's not the typical stuff that people set to music.
No, absolutely not. No, this is why. And also, you know, when we decided to start, the film with jazz, with loud, blurring jazz, tune, to really shock the people for a few minutes and then come back to, a nicer, more romantic melody. We wanted to shock first.
Why don't we hear the music from that opening scene in the gas station, where Guy has just finished working on a car?
Yes, and you know what's funny? Because the movie starts with "C'est terminé," it's finished. So we laughed, Jacques and I said, because we start with "It's over."
Right, and he's saying it's finished to the customer whose car he just finished. Yeah. Okay, here it is.
C'est terminé. Oui. Le moteur cliquait encore un peu à froid, mais c'est normal. Merci, merci. Tu peux faire une heure ce soir. Ce soir ça m'est difficile, mais je pense que Pierre est libre. Pierre, est-ce que tu peux rester ce soir?
Oui, tu vérifieras l'allumage de la Mercedes de monsieur.
That's music from the opening scene of The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, composed by Michel Legrand, who died Saturday. We'll hear more of our 1996 interview after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Creative Planning, an independent wealth management firm whose advisors are fiduciaries, legally bound to act in their clients' best interests. More at creativeplanning.com/NPR. Wealth management redefined. And from Indeed, used by over 3 million businesses for hiring, where employers can post jobs and use screener questions to build their short list of preferred candidates. Learn more at indeed.com/hire.
This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to my 1996 interview with pianist and composer Michel Legrand. He died Saturday at age 86. I spoke with him after the release of a restored version of the 1964 film The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. All the dialogue is sung. He composed all the music. Even though you weren't setting out to write songs, there were a couple of songs from The Umbrellas of Cherbourg that became very famous on their own and had a life outside of the movie. And I'm thinking from the main theme, which is known, I think, to a lot of Americans as "I Will Wait for You," and "Watch What Happens." Were you surprised that these became songs and became hits on their own?
Very much surprised, I'll tell you, because, first of all, Jacques and I, we couldn't find any producer in Paris who would put one franc in an adventure like that. Nobody believed in it. We went, we auditioned, to every possible producer in Paris, and nobody wanted to produce it because they said, "No, you're a couple of young, nice guys, but I don't believe that the audience will stay for 90 minutes, in a dark theater while people on the screen are singing, 'You give me the sword,' and singing." So no. It will never work. So hearing that for about a year, because, we auditioned about for a complete year, Jacques and I, we knew that, our movies, if by any miracle we could make it, would be a flop for sure.
And of course, the movie was not a flop, and neither was the music.
The opening night, right away, it was a success. So we were the first one amazed about it.
Now, I believe that none of the actors in Umbrellas of Cherbourg did their own singing. I believe each actor had a singer that dubbed for him or her. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. Because Jacques wanted to have the exact, you know, actor or actress for each role. And I wanted to have the best singer, male or female, for each character. But it was easy, you know, because nobody is speaking one word in that movie. So we could choose any kind of singing voice, you know.
When you were shooting the movie,
yeah,
and the actors had to lip sync to,
yeah,
the singers, was it hard for the,
no,
actors to get it just right and to,
no,
really be... Because so many movies where, you know, where it's dubbed like that, it looks really phony.
I know. But, I mean, you know, I was very, very careful with it, because when we recorded the singers, we asked the actors to be there at the recording studio. And we said to the actors, you have to say, bonjour, quelle heure est-il? How would you say that if you had to talk? So they said, bonjour, je vais bien. So we said to the singer, so you have to, you know, listen to the actor and try to sing in the speed that the actor would normally say it. So we worked very closely, you know, actors and singers together. All the actors were there when the singers were singing their parts in the studio with the orchestra. And after that, you know, we did some acetate discs. And we forced every actor and actress, you know, in the cast to work for a couple of months every day. And I was there with them almost every day to learn very well, you know, the music, the score.
What did it sound like when the actors, in order to be convincing, were actually singing, even though you weren't recording their voices, because their voices were being dubbed? But they had to actually sing so that they'd look convincing. Did they sing well, or was it funny to listen to?
No, it was funny to listen to them because they don't sing well. But I said, you know, you have to sing. Don't just, you know, move your lips. Scream, even if it's out of key, I don't care. But we must see, you know, you singing and acting. So they did it very well, very well.
I wish I could hear what that sounded like. I wish there was a recording of that.
No, I'm glad that you never heard it.
Instead, why don't we hear some more music from the original recording? This is one of the beautiful melodies from Umbrellas of Cherbourg that you composed. This is Americans will know it as Watch What Happens.
Mm-hmm.
But... this was so interesting to me because I knew the song first as Watch What Happens, which,
yep,
you know, was a very kind of popular pop hit.
Mm-hmm.
It's such, the second time it's sung in the movie, it's a song of such longing and disillusionment and love. I mean, there's a diamond merchant who's fallen in,
mm-hmm,
love with the leading lady, and he,
mm-hmm,
knows that she's in love with somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
But he knows that she was made for him. And he goes to her mother and says this: once I loved a woman, but she did not love me. Her name was Lola. Once disillusioned, I tried to forget. I left the country and went to the end of the world, but life was meaningless. Then by chance, I met you, and the moment I saw Genevieve, I knew she was made for me. And it's sung to this melody, a beautiful melody. Why don't we hear it, and then I'll talk to you about writing it.
Good.
Autrefois, j'ai aimé une femme, elle ne m'aimait pas, on l'appelait Lola. Autrefois, déçu, j'ai voulu oublier, alors j'ai quitté la France, je suis allé au bout du monde. La vie me paraissait sans attrait, et puis le hasard m'a mis sur votre route. Dès que j'ai vu Geneviève, j'ai su que je l'attendais. Depuis cette rencontre, ma vie a pris un autre sens. À tout instant, c'est elle que je vois. Je ne vis que pour elle. Je ne pense plus qu'à elle. J'ai voulu vous parler franchement. Vous ne m'en voudrez pas. Il n'est bien sûr pas question d'influencer Geneviève. Geneviève Elie.
Michel Legrand, what did you think about when writing this lovely melody?
You know, I thought of this is what the film wanted at that moment. You know, for me, the quality of a melody should, even if the melody is very complicated by itself, should sound to you like it existed for 1,000 years already. It should sound so natural. It should float naturally, like a bird singing his song. So I always try to, even if it's torn, you know, if it's complicated, sophisticated, it has to sound to you very natural. This is why I'm always looking when I write a melody in any style, you know, in any discipline. And this is what I tried on Cherbourg too.
Earlier when you were talking about how you and the director Jacques Demy were first conceiving of Umbrellas of Cherbourg, you said that one of the difficult things when you were thinking it would be a conventional musical was how do you get from the speaking parts to the singing parts? That transition on film always looks awkward. People always have a hard time with that. Have you, what has it been like for you to do musicals where you do have to make that transition from speaking to singing, where it's not sung all the way through?
We did, because right after Cherbourg, I mean, the success of Cherbourg, every producer who refused to produce Cherbourg came to us and said, oh, great, you guys, make us another Umbrellas of Cherbourg. Yes, we said, no, thank you. We've done it once. It's over. Now we'll do something else. And then we did a conventional, or so-called conventional, musical called The Young Girls of Rochefort with spoken parts and singing parts. And then I think we achieved pretty well, you know, the transition between what's said and what's sung.
And was it hard to make that transition between what's said and what's sung?
Hard, yes. Everything is hard. But it, you know, you have to be extremely keen and extremely, you know, subtle to bring the music when, you know, and suddenly, naturally, someone starts to sing. Not easy.
Michel Legrand, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, Terry, it's a pleasure.
My interview with Michel Legrand was recorded in 1996. He died Saturday at the age of 86. After we take a short break, Maureen Corrigan will review a new novel about a teenage girl who feels most like herself when playing basketball. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Dana Chapnick has spent most of her career on the editorial side of professional sports, including ESPN, the magazine. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan says that Chapnick's deep knowledge of sports served her well in writing her debut novel called The Falconer. Here's Maureen's review.
Here's a sentence of critical praise I never expected to utter. The descriptions of basketball games in this novel are riveting. The novel that's elicited this aberrant compliment is The Falconer by Dana Chapnick. It's a coming-of-age story set in early 1990s New York about an athletic 17-year-old girl named Lucy Adler. Lucy feels most like herself when she's playing basketball. Because she doesn't try to conform to the gender norms of the time, Lucy faces ostracism at school and some rough pushback from random guys on the public basketball courts where she often plays. The Falconer is a crossover book. It could be classified as a YA novel. It certainly will also appeal to adult readers like me. Coming of age in the New York of the 1960s and 70s, the closest I got to playing ball was bouncing a pink Spalding on the sidewalk. Girls didn't play on many sports teams in those pre-Title IX days, which maybe accounts for why I'm not much of a sports fan now. But Lucy's sweaty, all-in passion for basketball, which Chapnick captures so vividly in The Falconer, gives me a sharp sense of what I missed out on. Lucy's Jewish and Italian family is middle class and lives on the Upper West Side when that would have still been possible. Her best friend from childhood is a handsome rich boy named Percy Abney. He's also a really good basketball player, which adds to his popularity, even as it makes Lucy, who's seen as too tall and too fierce, a freak. Basketball is their chief bond, although Lucy nurses a serious crush on Percy. As she tells us, in the midst of playing one-on-one against him, colliding collarbones into shoulders, "Contact like this is what I live for." One night, though, after going to the planetarium together and smoking a lot of dope, they wind up having sex in his family's townhouse. Afterwards, Percy coolly advises Lucy not to get weird on him. Lucy is crushed. Walking home on a deserted West End Avenue afterwards, she pulls her smelly basketball warm-ups over her face and cries, "I wanted to be his secret discovery, but I am nothing, just another stupid girl." In the tradition of classic New York stories, Lucy does a lot of walking, and following her as she roams through vanished or now altered New York places is another pleasure of this novel. We're taken into her cousin's crummy tenement on the Lower East Side, grab a slice with her at the corner pizzeria, and tag along as she rides the subway, somewhat ironically, to her senior prom. One place that's especially important to her is the Falconer statue in Central Park. It's a real statue, much vandalized over the years, of a young boy in Shakespearean-type costume releasing a falcon into the air. Lucy tells us she loves it because it's reminiscent of the feeling when you hit the perfect jump shot. Some breathless blurbs of The Falconer have likened Lucy to Holden Caulfield, but I think the more fitting comparison is to Francie Nolan, heroine of A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. Like Francie, Lucy is self-aware and glazed over with a city girl toughness. She's distinguished not by prettiness, but by determination. Nowhere does that determination blast through more powerfully than in her frequent accounts of playing basketball. Here's one from the end of the novel, where Lucy describes playing a pickup game with a bunch of guys on a public court. One guy dribbles the ball between his legs a few times, briefly loses composure, a life below the rim. I could steal it easy, his ball handling shaky, but then everyone on the court will know that I'm not some trifle, and they'll get angry that a girl just made them look like asses, and I'll get double-teamed with a heat, and my game will be done. The trick is to let the pot boil slowly. Let them think you're just average or good for a girl, and then slowly, slowly, slowly begin to let your true self shine. That's the only way to avoid feeling the jealous, embarrassed rage of a dude who's been beat. There's so much more going on in The Falconer than just basketball, But as folks I know who love the game tell me, this seemingly speedy game slows down for good players. They can see everything happening on the court, every player, every movement, every possibility, with startling clarity. In The Falconer, Dana Chapnick displays this same gift. In bringing Lucy to life, she sees the whole game.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Falconer by Dana Chapnick. And we want to congratulate Maureen on winning this year's Nona Balakian Citation for Excellence in Reviewing from the National Book Critics Circle. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, we'll talk about working hard but living below the poverty line. My guest will be Stephanie Land, author of the new memoir Made, which chronicles how she ended up in a homeless shelter with her young daughter fleeing an abusive relationship. She writes about cleaning houses for a living, the hurdles to getting public assistance, and how she eventually put herself through college and became a writer. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our associate producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Home Advisor, matching homeowners with home improvement professionals for a variety of home projects, from minor repairs to major remodels. Homeowners can read reviews of local pros and book appointments online at homeadvisor.com. And from Capital One, committed to reimagining banking, offering savings and checking accounts that can be opened from anywhere. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A.